Hi, and thanks for listening to Heroes in Our Midst. I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop. And have you ever thought that world-class athletes were more than human? It seems to go together when they do extraordinary things. And then you get to know them. Or maybe you yourself become one. Dr. Christina Fink has done both. She competed in two Olympic Games for her home country of Mexico in the sport of high jump. And after that, found her way into the world of performance psychology. Now, usually when one is an expert in any given field, they spend most of their time explaining the best way to do things or the most beneficial way to approach any situation. But Christina doesn't necessarily do that. It's quite something, actually. She simply listens and creates a space where people feel heard. And perhaps the greatest gift she gives to the athletes she works with is the empowerment that comes from being heard, even in hearing yourself. Seems to me Dr. Christina Fink embodies exactly what we are trying to get across with this podcast project. For us all to be unapologetically human, to be okay with our own uniqueness, and to own it, whatever it is. But to truly appreciate Christina's message, you really do need to get a sense of what she's doing now and how she got to this point in her life. So, to give us a true sense of that, I asked her to tell us what her day-to-day looks like now.
So my day-to-day now is I am the Associate Athletic Director for Student Athlete Welfare at Rowan University. And I am very happy to be working there because I'm working with people who really value what I bring to the table. So the athletic director there is John Giannini, and he used to be the basketball coach for La Salle University. And I actually worked with him when he was a coach at La Salle. I was helping him with performance psychology there. And so when he moved to this position, and an opportunity opened up, I took it because I really enjoy working with him and his team. It's a very good group of people.
That right there struck me as what a great testament to the connections we make with people and the relationships that we foster with others, how important those are. I mean, it's really been a big part of where you are now.
Yes, definitely. It's funny because it's like a part of my story with the connections that I've had with coaches, the connections that I've had with young athletes, with older athletes. And ultimately, it is those connections and it is having those meaningful, you know, having meaningful conversations where you actually do it because you enjoy it and because you are happy to be a part of somebody's journey. And then that turns into something that actually ends up helping you as well.
Right. It's like payback without even asking for it. And I think that's a great lesson in life to learn that. And before we go back to your beginning, Christina, how is COVID? You just talked about connecting and really being a part of someone's journey, and COVID's made that difficult. How has it affected you and what you do?
So it is and it isn't, right? Because this is about you making the effort. So you're going to have to make a little bit more of an effort. I have been a performance psychologist for a very long time. And part of what I used to do is I would go to training sessions all the time. So I've worked with soccer teams and I'm part of the fabric, let's say, you know, that you're there and they're used to seeing you. And so it's easier for them to connect with you and stuff. So COVID for me was a challenge because I started at Rowan the week before we went into lockdown.
Wow.
So the week before we went into like everybody go home and we're virtual, I started working at Rowan. And so now I'm working at a university where I've met people once in person. You know, I haven't really been able to connect with a lot of people and now I have to establish these connections through Zoom, virtually, you know, with phone calls, with emails, and so does it take more of an effort? 100%. But if you're willing to put in that effort, then you can make those connections and you can have those meaningful conversations. And it actually opens you up a little bit because I used to be like, I don't do teleconference and I don't, you know, like I don't really like it that much. And so I'll do it if I have to, but I don't think that you can make the same connection. And now you're thrown into the situation where you have to, and you can either throw your hands up in the air and say, you can't do it, or you can say, how am I going to do this? And so part of doing that was actually starting with the coaches, making sure that the coaches knew who I was, making sure that I made some connections with them, talking to them about how they were dealing with COVID, not with anything else, you know, like, what are you going to do for your team or what? No, like, how are you doing as a human being? Right. And making those connections with the coaches and then making the connections with the student athletes. Unfortunately, we didn't only have COVID in the United States. You had the murder of George Floyd in the summer, which was absolutely horrible. And again, it was another event that helped us connect, that helped us have very meaningful conversations about racial justice and why we haven't moved the needle enough and what are some of the things that we need to do. And actually being part of the DEI, the Division of Equity and Inclusion at Rowan University, and forming with Penny Kemp a committee for student athletes that, and we're working towards that. And so having those conversations and talking to young people and being open for young people to tell you what you as an administrator or as a performance, you know, as an older adult, what you should be doing or how you can help, I think it was a great opportunity to be able to move forward with these horrible events.
What a challenge that, wow, I didn't know the timing of that and how close that was to when you started at Rowan. That's impressive.
Yeah.
So sport has been a part of your life for, well, forever. And
yes,
it became what you do and the heart of what you do as a sports psychologist. But you were quite an athlete yourself. I'd love for people to know your story and even it's really interesting where you grew up, where you were born. So take us back to the beginning.
Okay, back to the beginning. I was born in Mexico City. So I am a Mexican and I am American. So I have both. I was born and raised in Mexico City by a Mexican dad and an American mom. So I really grew up bicultural, not just bilingual. So we really grew up with having to, you know, especially because my mom is from the US and she missed the United States so much. You know, when you leave your country, there's things that you miss a lot. And so she was very, very patriotic and very, you know, it was so we grew up listening to a very positive view of the United States. And we grew up with living in Mexico with a positive view because my dad loved his country. And so we grew up with those almost kind of like taking the best of both and at times being a little bit naive about the other side of both countries. And both have absolutely wonderful things. And then both have things where they can definitely improve. So grew up with those two, grew up in a family of sports. Both my parents love sports. We played sports. We watched sports. We had no opportunity of saying, I don't want to participate. You had to choose your sport, but not choosing a sport was not an option, which I appreciate because it's also about being healthy and being, you can't see me. This is a podcast, but I am 6 foot tall. So I'm 181, about wow. 180, 181 in meters. And I love gymnastics and I wanted to do gymnastics and that was my pick. That was my sport. And I was horrible at it, but that was my sport because that was like the sport that I wanted to do. And I learned to play tennis and I swam and I did all these different things, but I wanted to do gymnastics and my parents allowed that. I mean, they would take me to gymnastics and sit through horrible competitions where I was on the balance beam and my legs are very long because I have the body of a high jumper. I have a very small torso and very long legs and I'm on the balance beam and my legs are actually touching the ground. So it was pretty pitiful, but because I got tall very quickly, I grew very, very quickly. And so, at 17, I discovered track and field and I was in the high jump because it's the closest thing to gymnastics where you get to jump and you land on a pit, you know, you jump backwards and you land on the pit and whatnot. And so on a high jump pit. And this coach came up to me and said, would you like to train for this? I had no idea that you could train for that because in Mexico, track and field is not as big as in the US. And so I was like, sure, I would love to. So fast forward to 1988, making the Olympic team. And they asked my dad, did you, you know, in an interview, you know, this big interview and whatnot, where they're interviewing all the parents and, you know, different, you know, siblings and stuff of Olympic athletes. And they asked my dad, did you think that, did you always know that Christina was going to be an Olympian? And my dad left out the biggest laugh and said, no. And if you had asked me of my four kids, because there's four of us, if you had asked me of my four kids, Christina would be the last one because she would trip over her shadow. And I laughed out loud at that. And there were people who told me that that was really mean of my dad. And I actually have always appreciated that, because that was like honest. It was aware, you know, like you have to be aware of who you are and what you are. And my dad was not apologetic about me being clumsy when I was young. Like, no, I didn't expect it. And he was like, I mean, my mom, I have to say my mom was my biggest supporter. My dad was a very, very close second. And so they were very, very supportive of me. They went to the Olympics to watch me compete. They were incredibly supportive, but he was also honest. I mean, if you ask me, I'm not going to tell you, oh, I knew since she was a baby. I mean, no, the answer is no. She was super clumsy. And I've always appreciated that side, because I think that being aware of who you are and what you bring to the table and how you were, I mean, I think it's just so important to be aware.
So were you always sort of a cerebral athlete? Like, do you think that helped you? I mean, the Olympic level, boom, you got there pretty quickly for us in your story, but that was quite a jump.
So I started, like I said, in 1983, I started, you know, competing in the high jump. And then it was like, okay, so I'm 17 years old, I'm competing in the high jump. I'm like, wow. And you know, you hear all of this about, like, now that I'm working as a performance psychologist, and I hear, you know, you talk about theories, and you have the theories of motivation and Desi and Ryan and self-determination and this and that. I am like the least athletic in my family, and I start jumping, and 2 weeks into my high jump career, I break a record that had been there for 22 years, and my name is in the paper. In Mexico, it was like a very big newspaper, like, let's say New York Times type, you know, like my name appears on the paper and it's like, you know, Christina Fink breaks this record, blah, blah, blah. And I am, especially with my two brothers who are incredibly athletic, and, you know, Carlos was part of the handball team, the Mexican handball team. And Antonio's my twin brother, and he was a Division I tennis player, right? And they're, you know, both over here. And I come over with a newspaper like this, and I go, ha, you know, so talk about extrinsic motivation. It's like, well, there you go. Right. And so very, very motivated internally as well. I mean, I loved it. I felt competent. I loved the feeling that I had in the high jump. I hated being tall. And all of a sudden I hear everybody telling me how envious they are of my height, and how they wish they were my height. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then all of a sudden I'm like finding myself happy with who I am and how I look. And so, and that's part of what sports gave me, like, you know, like saying, oh, it's okay to be this tall, you know, like, and so really understanding that part. And then when I moved to the University of Arizona to train, I competed for the University of Arizona and trained there. One of my, Bob Myers, my coach, who I absolutely adore, at one point said, you need to stop getting in your own way. Because I was so driven and determined and wanted it so much that sometimes I would overtrain, sometimes I would overthink. And so being at the University of Arizona, Gene Williams is, you know, one of the pioneers of sports psychology. And she gave a class called Peak Performance. And all of a sudden I'm in this class, and in that class, you have all of these athletes like Sean Elliott and Steve Curry, you know, all these big names of Arizona athletes who are in this class, you know, and taking this class. And we are in that class. And I actually started learning, you know, how to, at the time, they used to say that you need to control your thoughts. And I never understood that, because I have always been, you know, like, you don't control your thoughts or your emotions, you manage them. But actually thinking, oh, okay, so you can actually choose what to think, and you can actually, and so learning about that as an athlete was very helpful. And that's what got me, you know, I moved to University of Arizona because I didn't have a coach in Mexico. and ended up with Bob Myers and ended up going to the Olympics in 88, qualifying for the Olympics in 88, thanks to my training with Bob. So very, very thankful for all of those opportunities.
And what was that Olympic experience like for you, your very first Olympics in 88?
Unreal. So it's in Korea, right? So it's in Seoul, Korea. And my parents were not going to come because it's in Seoul, Korea. And 2 weeks before the Olympics, my dad calls and says, and this is pre cell phones and pre all of these, you know, like 88. I mean, I know it sounds like it's the dark ages, but but you didn't have internet and you didn't have, you know, when I described to my kids, like when I was in college and had a typewriter and it's like, what? Right. My dad calls me like, you know, like our Sunday call, my dad calls and says, and my dad calls on a Thursday, not on our Sunday call, because we used to talk on Sunday. And he calls me on a Thursday from his office. And I'm actually like a little bit worried because I'm like, what's happening? Why are you calling me? And he said, so your mom and I made some arrangements and we're flying out, to see you at the Olympics. And so we're actually, I actually called the Mexican Olympic Committee. They have some passes for us, you know, because he was friends with someone. And then they ended up in the same flight. So they flew to LA and I flew from Arizona to LA and we ended up flying together to Seoul, Korea. And that was amazing. And I had a really good Olympic experience. Everything was where it needed to be. You know, Bob was actually the coach for the US team. Oh, yeah. For the high jump. And so, but I was competing. So he actually talked to me and said, I can't help you at the Olympics because I'm actually with the US team and you're competing for Mexico. So I can't help you, but know that I'm with you. And I knew that. And so it was like that connection and that, and so I saw him there and we talked and, you know, so it was a great experience altogether. So the Seoul Olympic Games, I loved it. As athletes, we were able to enjoy all of the different events that were going on and stuff. So it was really a matter of balancing, enjoying the Olympics while still focusing on what you needed to do to compete well. Mm-hmm. And so that went well. 92 was a different story. 92, I was already working as a performance psychologist. So I was working, I wasn't working directly with any of the athletes, but I was a director of psychology for the Olympic Committee for Mexico. So I left that position 6 months before the Olympics because I thought I can't do that and compete.
Yeah.
There were so many different things. And the coach that I was with ended up having to leave 6 months, like 8 months before the Olympics. He left because his wife had cancer in Poland and he went back to Poland. And so I ended up with a new coach 6 months before the Olympics. That coach was wonderful, but he and I never really, you know, like I peaked way too early. There were so many things. And I ended up having my best year. My most consistent year. I was ranked top 10 in the world. It was really, you know, like at some point I was in that top 10 list in track and field, you know, and I had a horrible competition at the Olympics. And I was like, I wanted to be as far removed from sports as possible. I did not want to have anything to do with sports ever again. I was so disappointed with myself first, with the whole experience, and just really, really blaming myself, like being very, very hard on myself, just really not being kind. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I have a couple of friends who are very kind and who rather than pitting me and saying like, oh yeah, I know, poor you, they were like, wow, like really, like you're that mean, you know, like to yourself, like that's not okay, you know, like mm-hmm. It's not okay for you to be that harsh. And I was like, well, I know, but you know, like for me, it was like, if I could just pretend like I never went, that would be better. Mm-hmm. I removed myself from sports, right? And I'm like, okay, I'm not doing sports psychology because how am I going to do sports psychology if I couldn't compete well? And then I end up working for Adidas. So not very far removed from sports, right? No. They were my sponsors and they offered me a really good position. And I end up doing really well there. And I am their, you know, their public relations and marketing person. And then I end up going to the Pan American Games as an Adidas rep to Mar del Plata in Argentina, and I have athletes there coming up to me saying, can you help me? And I was like, sure. And I started talking to a couple of athletes, and they were like, why are you not doing this? Like, and one of them actually said, you're very helpful because you've had both.
Yeah.
You know what it's like to have the good and the bad. And I was like, well, yeah. And then I thought, that's true. So I decided to, between having kids and working, I went ahead and got a master's and then a PhD in performance psychology, because I thought if I'm going to do this, I need to educate myself more and work through my own experience so that I don't, the fact that I've been through it doesn't mean that I know all of it.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I tell athletes all the time when they say, you know, I had an athlete who had a pretty severe injury. And he asked me if I had had injuries, and I said, yes. And I said, I had a season ending injury, you know, like that, you know, ended that season. And then I had to get back to, and this athlete was going through something similar. And so he said to me, well, then you know what it's like. And I said, I know what it was like for me. Why don't you tell me what it's like for you? Because I can't assume that you're going through exactly the same things that I went through, because we're two very different people. So that has been helpful.
Amazing. So I think about 92. So you basically retired from sport. You were quitting sports. You were done with that whole thing. And even up until 95. So it's 3 years you worked for Adidas.
So it's funny because it's more like public relations. And I am actually working with athletes, you know, like I'm the connection with athletes too. And so athletes would come to see what their package was for Adidas, you know, like their sponsor, and then would end up talking to me about the sport. And then I would end up getting involved in performance psychology type of thing. And so, yeah.
Christina, take us to those days you threw in there, getting married, having children. And some of us women are listening going, okay, I did that. I got married, but I did not do a master's or a PhD. And then also, you know, you had all this performance psychology, and I'm sure you were still talking to athletes as that time went on. Do you remember those times, or was that a blur? How did you balance that? And how did you figure out your day to day then?
So I have an ex-husband, but at the time, so I got married very, very young. I got married at 21, and I decided, you know, like we went to Arizona together, and we were, and so we had decided that we were not going to have kids until after the 92 Olympics. So competed in the 92 Olympics. And then that was, so we were married for 7 years before we had kids. And so we had in 93, I had my son Carlos, and then in 95 I had Pablo, and then I was working with Adidas during that time.
Right.
And so once Pablo was born and I decided that I wanted to go back to school. So the one thing that I will say is, this is going to sound so funny, but the moment that I decided that I needed to actually deal with the emotions that I had from the Olympics, I was at my dentist and she was doing a root canal. So I'm with my mouth open, she's doing a root canal, and she's working on my mouth, and she starts talking about her Olympic experience. It turns out that she was an Olympic swimmer in 68. She was one of the youngest swimmers for Mexico, and she had a horrible experience. And while she's doing, you know, while she's working on the root canal, she's crying, telling me her whole experience. And she's crying because she's saying that she can't take her daughter to the swimming pool because it just brings so many emotions to her. And I remember I already had Carlos and I was, you know, pregnant with Pablo. And I thought, I can't give that to my kids. Like, I can't bring that emotion to my kids. Like, I don't want them to have that. And so I ended up working with the dentist, like giving her advice on how to deal with her, you know, how to, and 3 appointments later with a root canal and whatnot, she's telling me that she was able to go to the swimming pool where she swam in 68 and like sit way at the top, and her daughter was going to swim. And she's like sitting way in the top, just crying her eyes out, you know? And so I think it's funny now that I hear people talk about, you know, like, oh, you have to wait, you know, like a week or two to unpack the experience or whatever. I mean, this is a woman who swam in 1968, and in 1995, she's telling me that she's struggling with this. I'm telling you now, I mean, I still, like, I don't like watching the 92 Olympics. Like, if it's on TV, I'm like, I'm not watching those. I mean, you know, it's strong emotions. It's very strong emotions. And so whether they're positive or negative, or you come to terms with them, they do move a lot.
Yeah. And it's amazing how, when sport is your life, I think some people say, well, I haven't been ever been an athlete. I can't relate. I'm telling you, you talk a lot about performance psychology, which bridges all disciplines and all areas of life. And so do you feel, as a sports psychologist, that you should be unpacking that, or that you should have already had that all figured out?
So I had the opportunity to go to the 96 Olympics, and that was helpful because I was invited into some meetings as an athlete representative, not, you know, because of my work with Adidas and with this and that and the other. And I ended up going to the 96 Olympics, and I ended up making peace with the Olympics, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, after the 92, it was like actually being able to go and not being full in, just kind of taking it all in and being like, okay with it. And then I was able to go to the 2000, 2004 and 2008 Olympic Games as a performance psychologist, you know, like working as a sports psychologist in 2000 and 2008 with specific sports, but in 2004 as the Olympic, as the sports psychologist of the Mexican delegation. And so having come to terms with that and understanding the impact that the Olympics have and how much of your identity is interwoven in that, and how much that pulls and what it means, I think is very important. I don't like watching the 92 Olympic Games because I didn't do well.
Sure.
But it's not like a, because before it was like, I don't want to go back to Barcelona.
Yeah.
And wow. Talk about missing like a great city, right?
Right. Yeah.
I was actually able to go back to Barcelona a couple times. And then I actually went with my kids when my kids were 14 and 16. And we're in Barcelona. I'm in Barcelona with my kids, and we're walking around. They were 15 and 17, and we're walking around, and they said they wanted to go to the Montjuic Stadium. I had not been back there since I competed.
Wow.
So I had been back to Barcelona, but not to the Olympic Stadium. And I said, sure, let's go. You know, let's go. And we went. And this is an age where your kids are like not particularly fond of getting pictures taken and, you know, whatnot. And they actually gave the camera to this guy and said, can you take a picture with us, with me, with the two of them, because they wanted a picture at the stadium that their mom competed in. And so that changed everything for me. So you start seeing, so when you start seeing things from different perspectives, so it's like, you know, for me, it has like this, I didn't perform well. For my kids, it's like, this is where my mom competed in the Olympic Games. So that was like, oh yeah. So I guess I could be proud of that.
Absolutely. And should be, yeah. But you know, thank goodness for those that are around us and surrounding us. And they were just so proud of you. Wonderful boys. So obviously yeah. That experience to have that in your, I guess, toolbox, would you say, when you're working with athletes at that level, because you're not going to ask an athlete after a week, okay, this is how we should unpack it, or this is how we should talk about it, this is how you should feel, because you've lived an experience like that.
And so here's the thing too, that whenever I hear it, this is how you should, or this is what you need to do, it's like, that's not being very respectful of people's process. Mm. You know, so I'm here for you. Tell me what you need from me. So how do you want to deal with this situation? How do you, I don't say you should unpack it this way, you know, or this is what we should be going through, or, you know, because in the end, whether you want to or not, it's a loss. You know, and so, and we grieve differently. And so how do you grieve with it? Are you in denial? Are you angry? Are you bargaining? Are you accepting, you know, like, where are you? And I'm not trying to minimize like a real loss, you know, like when you lose a person, not at all. But at times when you put so much of yourself into something and you have a loss, whether it's because of an injury, whether it's because you didn't perform, you know, like what, the feeling that you have, even when you do really, really well, the event finishes and then what, you know? And so those transitions are so important. And it's so important to be educated about that when you're helping someone.
Totally. And actually you're truly allowing them to be the human that they are, not that anyone else is, and what strength that they can gain from that and knowing that you respect that, the human that they are. So obviously your motivation to help all of these wonderful humans in this high level of sport, I mean, leading into those three Olympic Games, that's an incredible accomplishment in itself to be associated and to be asked to be associated and to be sort of on the team or on the journey with these athletes. And what was that like leading up? Maybe lead us now from 95, getting your master's, getting your doctorate. Where did that all fit in? Maybe with these Olympic experiences as now a sports psychologist. Lead us through that part of your life and how that first Olympics in a new way was.
So 2000 was a new way of looking at things. And it was so, I was so fortunate that it was those Olympics, because the Olympics in Sydney are for me the best by far that I've ever been to. It was the most Sydney, those were the Olympics for the athletes. Other Olympics were about showcasing this and that or the other. It was the first Olympics that actually had an environmentally conscious movement through it. They had all of these separate, you know, bins or trash cans for recycling, for, you know, for doing all that. Was 2000 in the Olympics, which sounds absurd that it was not until 2000, but it is 2000 that they started, you know, at the Olympics, having separate bins, having separate, really, really conscious of making sure, you know, every volunteer, there were all of these volunteers who were retired people driving you around, and every single one, every single event was full. I mean, I was in 88 in the track and field prelims in the morning. There was nobody there. You know, you feel like you're in a track meet out in, you know, the boonies, I don't know where, because there were very, I mean, it's like your parents and two other people there. I mean, it's like not that many people. In Sydney, every event and every, it was packed. And so the volunteers would say, yeah, we got, I just remember this so well, because one of them said, yeah, we have an opportunity to go see the 400 meter runner that was, and we have an opportunity to go see her in the first 400 meters, you know, like the prelims where, and that stadium was completely packed for prelims, for semifinals, for finals. I mean, every event, and they would ask you, what sport do you do? Not if you do sports, you know, I mean, it was like, so I kind of felt back like to my childhood where, which sport do you do?
Right.
So those Olympics were absolutely amazing. And it was amazing to be able to actually be able to reconnect and work with people during those Olympic Games and just seeing that experience. I worked with an athlete who ended up having an injury, a bad injury, and at the Olympics. And it was devastating because he was a medal hopeful. And I remember when he had the injury, I just lost it. I mean, I just started crying and I was like, oh. And one of the coaches came up to the stands and said, he wants you down there. And I was like, what am I going to say? Like, what could I possibly say? You know, so I was like a little bit like, so I collected, you know, like on the way down, I'm like trying to collect myself and I'm like, okay, I'm calm. I'm okay. And I realized how important, you know, like I was so devastated for him that I was crying. And I'm thinking, I can't help this person. I fortunately had a sports psychologist there that, that I really trust. And who said to me, this is why you're good, because you connect so strongly to people. Right. And so I went down to the area where this athlete was, and I just, you know, grabbed his hand, and he just kept going like, this is unreal. This is unbelievable. And he just said, you understand. And I just said, yes. And we were both crying. Fast forward to 4 hours later, you know, where he's bandaged and we're finally leaving. There was a family with an 8 and a 6-year-old that waited until we came out, because they were waiting for him because he was such an example for them. And that to me was it. I mean, that was like, this is the part of sports and the part of that some people don't understand and that people don't get. And that's the part that was like super meaningful to me. And that was like, and I was so happy to be there and for him to experience that. to be able to hear that, because you never know who you're going to impact. You never know what you're leaving behind, you know, what's the impact that you're having. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. I find it the most amazing part of that almost for me is that you cried. But I love that it breaks the barriers of, you know, the thought process of, well, you're supposed to keep it together to help that poor athlete. But in you being honest and again, being human and not being afraid to say, listen, we are going to cry together about this because you're right. I get mm-hmm. it. I feel it. I feel you. Had the most impact on him. Yeah. I can see why that sticks with you and probably will forever. And
forever. And, you know, and so the thing is, it wasn't like, oh my God, I go down there and I'm like, oh my God, you know, it wasn't right. like that. I mean, it was like, it was a question of going down there. Yes, you can see that I'm affected too. I'm affected, but I'm affected for you.
Right.
I'm not crying because I hate the Olympics. No, I'm devastated for you, but I'm with you. Mm-hmm. And so I'm here. And so you don't have to go through this alone.
That's great.
Yeah.
So now you stayed in this line of, obviously you're still in this line of work. So that's an obvious, but three Olympics, 2000, mm-hmm. 2004, 2008. I'd love to know, you mentioned that one story sport. What sports have you all worked in? Olympic sports, I should say.
So Olympic sports, I have worked with divers, synchronized swimmers, volleyball players, basketball players. I have worked with modern pentathlon, track and field, swimming, shooting, badminton, taekwondo, soccer, and rowing.
Wow. I'm curious what you would say, working with so many different sports. Sometimes I look at team sports. Well, we have our teammates, or, you know, individual sports, or sports that are timed, or sports that count on, like diving, it's that dive, or it's that race in track. Some sports, they have a tournament. You have a bad match. Well, you can still come back and still make the gold medal or whatever. Is there a sport that you've worked with that was the most challenging?
For me, the most challenging working with team sports was not at the event, but the prior to the event, the people that get cut that were in camps. And that's hard. And I was part of some of those conversations, and I continue to be part of those conversations, because at times, like I remember for one World Cup, working with a women's national team from Mexico, we cut somebody. But this was a young player, and the coach wasn't going to take this player to this World Cup, but wanted to make sure that this player didn't get demotivated for future events, because this player is going to be a good player for Mexico for years to come. And so he wanted me to be part of that conversation, and actually having that conversation with a young player and saying, don't be demoted. It's like, yeah, like, And I just said, I can't say that. I can't say don't be something. Like, I, you know, you be you. And of course you're going to be disappointed. And of course you might be demotivated. That doesn't mean you can't continue, or that you won't go on, or that you won't bounce back or be more resilient. But that part of team sports, that one's a hard one. And then having conversations with some athletes, obviously, this is, I've established, I've been working with this athlete for many years, and we have a very good relationship. And he started complaining. I know that I'm using mostly he. I have a couple of very good she stories as well. But this particular athlete was complaining a lot about his sport. You know, he's a, and he just goes like, well, the refs and this and that. And I just looked at him and I was like, you picked the wrong sport, dude. You know, if you were a runner, like you just, you know, you run, you take off, and here you depend on referees and you depend on, and so that is the culture of your sport. Deal with it. The only way that you can make sure that the ref doesn't take the bout from you is by knocking your opponent out. So knock him down. I was like, let's get real here. What is, and you know, obviously this comes because I have a very strong relationship with this athlete, so I can be that candid with him. Or her. And then I would be able to say, so what are the things that you can control, and how do we manage those? And how do you manage the things that you don't control? Because you don't control them, but you can manage them. So I don't control the ref, but if I keep arguing with the ref, I'm influencing him in a very negative way. So if I start So if I don't focus on that and I'm not giving the ref any, you know, lip, then things might go in my favor. So let's train for that, you know? So actually thinking about what are the things that you control? What are the, you know, the, your behavior, your attitude, your effort, those are things that you control. What are things that you manage, your thoughts and your feelings, and how the things that you don't control affect you. Those are things that you manage.
Do you have a good story or a great memory of, you know, working with someone who, when you allowed them to be human and the performance was elevated?
So number one, I would say that I am not the keeper of that. So I'm not the one who allows it or disallows it. You have to do that yourself, right? So yes, but you do have people around you that might make you feel like you can't be that person, right? And so I'm very, very conscious of making sure that I am not a barrier, but that I am like a safe space for athletes to be who they need to be, right? And so for me, when somebody says, oh, but you allow it, I'm like, well, no, because it's not mine. So it's not like really me allowing it, right? So to start off with, but I'll tell you a story with, I was working with a synchronized swim team and they were talking quite a bit about the coach and the coach being from a different country and how they thought it was hilarious to teach her all the cuss words, right? And so they thought that was very funny. But then she started using them. And she started using them as feedback, you know, like giving feedback. She would actually say the cuss words, you know. So she would say, excuse my language, but she would actually say, what you're doing is shit, you know. I mean, like, this is shit. So she would, and she would say in Spanish, and it sounds a little bit harsher. I mean, it's like, es una mierda. I mean, she would be like very, and so it was like, oh my God, you know, they started getting very upset about it. They were very upset about it. And so the first thing that I did when they started talking to me about that is I actually asked who taught her those words. And they started kind of giggling and stuff. And they were like, well, we did. And I was like, well, like, then let's start by acknowledging that. Let's start by taking that responsibility, right? And so you take responsibility for that. And now what can you do? Like, what can you do? We're like, you know, and I can actually share this story because this is a story that some of the athletes have shared. And so I can actually, I have permission to share this. So some of the athletes would get very upset when she was giving feedback. And so one of the things that I said was, when she gives feedback, she starts with this, but then what she tells you, is it valuable or not? And they said, yes, it is. Like, once you get past the insult, let's say, the information that she has is actually good. And I was like, okay, well then can you actually have a filter for it rather than trying changing it or trying to, because we established that we weren't going to change coaches. We weren't going to change the coach. They weren't going to tell the coach that she shouldn't be saying that. I mean, like, we had like this whole, you know, debrief about it. And we came to the conclusion that what we needed is, so they said, we need to have a filter. And so the filter was, because you have athletes who would just shut down completely. Like, I don't care. And I don't hear blah, 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 blah. And I don't hear her anymore. So I don't hear the second part that's actually helpful. Then I had athletes who would just break down and start crying. And so again, shut down, can't hear it. Right. And so with both of them, we said, you need to have a filter. So just thinking of the filter in the pool, you know, what comes through and what doesn't. And so they started saying to each other in the pool, check the filter, to help each other with it, right? So they were like, check the filter. And so I'm talking to the coach about a month before the Olympics. And she says to me, they are doing so much better. They just have an obsession with a freaking filter. But other than that, we're fine. And I was, because at one point she's like, pool filter is fine. And I was like, okay, that was one of the ones that's one of my favorite stories, because I just think that it was after the Olympics, they actually came clean with her and said that the filter was for this. And she was very upset about it because she was like, you didn't give me an opportunity to be better, which I really appreciated, because she said, if you had talked to me about it, yes, it would have been hard to change that behavior, but I would have been willing to change that behavior. And you didn't give me an opportunity to change that. And I thought that was very valuable. And it was a lesson for me as well, because I feel like I maybe should have pushed a little bit into, let's have a talk with the coach about it. And I didn't. And so that's one of the lessons for me, where maybe, you know, like, it wasn't my challenge to take, but I could have influenced that in a different way.
Yeah. Interesting. And the perspectives you learn as you get yet another experience in your vast career. So Christina, speaking of experiences, soccer is a big thing that you do. What an interesting sport for you to be in. And is it men that you work with mostly? And is it in a man's world that you work mostly in your soccer experience?
So I started with the women's national team. I started working with the women's national team. So I actually, my introduction to soccer was through the women's national team in Mexico, which I absolutely loved. I worked with them for 8 years. And I loved every minute of it. In 2004, the Olympics, you're not going to like this, but Canada was number 4 in the world and Mexico was 36 at the time. And we actually went to Costa Rica to play and Mexico beat Canada. We beat, we won. And I say we because I was part of that team.
Yeah.
And we prepared so, so well for that in every single aspect of it, you know, from the physical to the cognitive, to the mental, to the emotional. We actually talked about what we were going to do when we were up against Canada 1-0, or when we were up against Canada 2-0, because we knew what it was like being down, because in November we had lost 8-0 and 6-0 to Canada in these invitational tournaments. And then we go to Costa Rica to the actual Olympic qualifier, and we end up beating Canada 2-1. And it was, it was very funny because I was with one of the people that was helping with the training and stuff. The two of us were not on the bench. We were up on the stands. In the last 10 minutes, I just kept looking at the clock, and Canada was like on top, and it was crazy. And it was, you know, it was just so, so intense. And I just kept looking at the clock and it just was not moving. And I turned to this person and I just said, I feel like I'm in math class. And he just burst out laughing because he said, oh my God, I feel exactly the same way. It turns out that he wasn't good at math either. And so we both were like, wow, you know. But so my introduction was through the women's game, and I loved it. And I have always been connected to that. Mm. Later on, I started working with professional teams, ended up working for 10 years with the Philadelphia Union, and then left that to go to Rowan for a different opportunity. And I'm now working with the Football Science Institute, which is a group of professionals from all of these different disciplines. And we work on educating on with soccer. And so, you know, it's a Football Science Institute, and we have all of these different programs to, you know, with from sports science to performance psychology to, you know, how to be a better director of an academy to all of these different things. And it's been an interesting experience. And it's been an interesting experience because I also have a son who's a professional soccer player. So it's funny to me because I'll tell you a funny story. I was, as a performance psychologist, already working with the Philadelphia Union, and I was with their academy program. And I had a dad who, this was at the very beginning, and it was like a Union Juniors program, and they invited me to talk to all the parents to talk about the experience and stuff, right? And so I'm sitting there, and one of the dads thought that I was a mom who was also part of the, because these are all different teams and stuff, so they don't know each other very well. And so he just thought I was another mom in the program. And so the director comes out and goes, okay, everybody come in, we're gonna start this session. And the session was with me on how to be a good sports parent or whatnot, right? And so the guy that I'm sitting next to, he turns to me and goes, oh, let's go listen to this bullshit. And I was like, whoa. So I walk in, you know, I'm sitting next to him in the classroom. I went and sat right next to him, and I'm sitting right next to him. And the guy who's introducing, you know, the director who's introducing me, he says, you know, doctor in sport in performance psychologist, And then he says two-time Olympian. And all of a sudden, like a couple of parents are like sitting up a little bit more, you know, because at first everybody's like this, you know, like kind of like arms crossed and kind of like sitting back. And then they say two-time Olympian and they kind of like straighten up a little bit and, you know, uncross their arms and they're a little bit more. And then they say, and the mom of a soccer player who's playing in Spain and, you know, who's already in an academy in Spain. And so now I have their attention, right? And so his guy, and so the director says, Dr. Christina Fink, and I get up and this guy is sitting right next to me. And I just patted him on the leg and I just said, I'll try to keep the bullshit to a minimum. And I got up and started talking about it, right? And so I have never in my life had anybody be more attentive to every word that I was saying. He was awesome. He was like super interested, raising his hand, like super cooperative. It was hilarious. But yeah, so having experiences with men in the men's space, you know, I went to this one event and we had 45 guys and me, and we're at a restaurant and one of the waiters says, oh, are you the soccer mom to me? And the head coach turns around and goes, no, she's the doctor. So it was so fun to see him being offended for me. It was great. So I was very supported by him. So I've been fortunate enough to work with great, great men who are very respectful of women. And I have also worked with the other side. Let's just say it like that.
Are men allowed less to be human than women athletes?
I think that when we start getting to the higher levels, to the highest levels, it used to be that women were not as emotional. So that was good. Mm-hmm. And I feel like fortunately now we are seeing that yes, they are, and that men are allowed to be emotional as well. I think that one of the things that 2020, which almost makes me, I mean, it's just like 2020 started as a very, very, I mean, everybody was like, oh, such a promising year in 2020 and whatnot. And I'm sure that now when you think of looking back, you're never going to say, oh, hindsight is 2020. I don't think anybody will use that phrase ever again. But when you think about it, so Kobe Bryant died in January,
right,
with his daughter.
Yeah.
So that's how 2020 started, like in the sports world, right? If you think about it. So if you think about it, that happened and that was horrible because yes, he made some mistakes, but he owned up to them. And then he was like the biggest supporter of women's sports and just a very great women's, you know, girl's dad and just an advocate for women's sports and just really pushing the envelope. Whenever he was interviewed and they would say something like, oh, don't you want a boy for your legacy? And he would always say that Gianna was going to be better than him. And so that's how it started, right? And then we had COVID, and then we had George Floyd. And then you have, athletes like LeBron James crying on national TV, right? And you have like being very, very human. I mean, like being able to cry, being able to say, this is not okay. This is not okay on all of these different levels, right? I mean, whether they were crying, you know, like in January, February, over Kobe or in May, June with all of the social and racial injustices. Because I mean, George Floyd is like the one that just was horrifying. But then you think of Brianna and you think of, you know, like there's all of these stories and all of these stories that keep coming out that I think are actually allowing for having conversations that are more into who you are as a person, not just as an athlete and not just the shut up and dribble, you know, like, well, guess what? You don't get to tell me that. And now I love the fact that this woman, you know, says something like, you know, and I know it was a couple of years ago, but you know, that she's like, oh, shut up and dribble. And now there is a series called Shut Up and Dribble that it's actually empowering, you know, all these NBA players talking about different things. And so I love that. I think we need to have more of that. I think we need to have more of that connection.
For sure. And do you think as a female working in a high level sport, it's a lot of men, what do we need to do? Sometimes women wonder.
So fortunately, it wasn't a lot of men. It was only a couple. So there's a couple of things that I did at the beginning of my career that I'm happy that I did. I remember working with one coach that would cuss all the time. Mm-hmm. But every time, so if I was around, every time he cussed, he would turn around and say sorry to me. Hmm. Right. So he would be like, blah, 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 cuss word. Oh, sorry, Christina. And then continue. And then one day, so that was like the first couple of times he would do that. And then I noticed like this pattern. And then it was him and me having coffee. And I just said, I'm going to ask you for a favor. All the bad words that you say, I know them all. Like I actually use them. Like I have a pretty bad mouth. Like I've cleaned up my act, but I can have a pretty bad mouth. And so I know them. I know all of them. So I'm not shocked. I'm not. So either stop saying them or stop apologizing. Like, you know, like either you stop saying it because you're aware of it. And so you're saying it. And so what's the purpose of saying it? Because besides, for me, it's like, what are you saying that bad word for? And that's how I've been able to start like almost like cleaning up my act with when I use a bad word, you know, when I use a cuss word, what am I using it for? What's the intent of it? What, and what impact is that going to cause? Because when I'm joking around and stuff, I don't mind. But if I'm serious or if I'm angry, you will not hear me use cuss words when I'm angry, because then it means you have zero control. Like right. You are not managing your emotions. You're not managing your thoughts. You're just, you know. And so when this coach is using this as a, you know, this is me driving a point, please don't apologize to me. Like, I think that it's a good way of you using, when you're just saying it to be hurtful and then you turn and go, oh, sorry, you're just pointing me out and I don't want to be a part of it. And for me, it's a question of why are you not apologizing to one of the guys?
Right.
Because this is a question of, I mean, like, you're doing it because of, you're apologizing to me out of respect. So do you not respect any of the men that are here? Like, I mean, like, that's a double standard that I won't, I don't want it. I don't need it. And so if cussing is a really big part, I mean, like, I've been in situations where they're cussing, you know, up a storm laughing, and I'm laughing right there with you. Like, I really don't care, as long as you're not offensive. And as long as it's not one of those where, you know, you start belittling women or like that, you know, I'm not, no, it's not funny. And I will say it's not funny.
Yeah. Awesome.
And please don't do that in front of me.
Exactly. Showing your strengths and just being who you are. Again, being who you are and not apologizing for it. Love that. My last question before we get to some rapid fire questions, I'm curious, as a mom and as a, you know, a strong woman in your sport and in your field and in what you do, you have two sons. You have two sons that obviously look up to you. One's an athlete, one's not, but they're both living life. And hopefully in COVID now, perhaps things are paused in some ways, but they're living life and you're watching them do it. Of all you've seen in terms of performance and life and being human, and, you know, what do you hope for your boys? What do you hope they've garnered from some of the conversations you've had with them? Because sometimes that means the most. I think about that because I also have two boys who are just entered adulthood, and we have conversations not just about sport but about how that translates into life. What would you say to that?
So they are my driving force. They are my people that have taught me the most. They taught me a part of a strength, you know, of being strong, of actually being able to manage two incredibly different, incredibly resilient individuals. Carlos is an incredibly smart and kind person, and he speaks 8 languages, and he has like this, you know, just this need for knowledge, and he will check you every time. Like, anything that I send, it's like, did I double check my source before I send it? Because I know I'm going to get smacked. And I love that. I mean, I love that. And he is one of the most resilient people I've ever met. He's just amazing. And then Pablo, I mean, I'm saying this, I'm thinking Pablo is an athlete. You know, he's a professional soccer player who's also studying, you know, doing university online so that he can be, because he's also smart. So he's not, you know, it's like whenever I talk about this, I have people that say to me, oh, you have the smart one and the jock. And I was like, I have two smart kids. I have one who's a professional athlete and one who decided not to be an athlete. You know, he's, I mean, it's like he has other interests and other things. He has athletic ability, but was not interested in being an athlete. And I have to respect that. I learned a lot about classical music because of Carlos, because Carlos played the piano and he was really into classical music. And I got into classical music because of him. So, you know, it's like, and then Pablo is, again, one of the, you know, again, I'm going to say he's incredibly resilient, has gone through major, you know, he, in 2018, he had a bad injury in the shoulder, got over that, and then started playing again. And the game that he comes back and starts playing again, he gets hit on the side, goes down, finishes the game. He gets hit in the 75th minute, plays for another 15 minutes. And then after the game starts feeling really, really bad, ends up in the ER, and they had to remove his spleen because his spleen ruptured. Wow. And so he had a ruptured spleen, and he almost, I mean, he was, we almost lost him, which is like, I cannot even, I mean, I would start crying if I, so for me, it's one of those where, you know, and again, he comes back and then he gets a contract with LAFC out in California, a different perspective, a different, you know, and so now he's in LA, he's the starting goalie, he's doing well. And so for me, they're my biggest inspiration. And so, and they're the reason why I, you know, like, they're the reason why I feel like, oh, it's the right thing to do. I think about my kids.
Awesome. Awesome. And you're a goalie mom, not just a soccer mom.
But see, that's where I think that my experience has been very helpful, because for me, it's like, yes, I'm his mom and everything, but it's Pablo's experience.
Yes.
Yeah. And I want to be with him and I want to help him through it, but it's his experience. It's not mine. And I can't be like all over it. And I mean, it's yes. And it's funny because when I'm in a game where I'm live, where I can see him, where I'm in the stadium, yes, I'm nervous, but I'm not that nervous because I'm like, you know, I'm watching him. And when I'm watching him on TV, oh my God, because I can't see him, because they don't show you the goalie unless the goalie is under attack. So that's where I'm like, ah!
That's so great. You know what I think one of the most wonderful things about you, Christina, is you truly take to heart. What I hear is you truly take to heart what you can control and what you can't. And the rest, you empower others to control what they can control, and you implore them to do so, and simply let them know that you will be there when they do. And I have learned that today. I think that is a wonderful attribute, but it's wonderful for all of us in that it strips us of the responsibility that we're taking on that's not ours to begin with. And it helps others to be empowered. We're not going to do this for you because we really can't.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Now we have some great rapid fire questions, the same questions to each of our guests. And so we're going to run through them and see what we get. What is your favorite sound?
The ocean.
What does being unapologetically human mean to you, and why is this important?
I think that when we hear unapologetically human, a lot of times we start thinking about too many things. And for me, it's about being true to yourself and actually allowing for all emotions, not just the good ones and not just the bad ones, but for all emotions to be there, you know, because that's what we're made of, you know. I mean, like those feelings, like not push away those feelings, not push, like, yeah, in one moment I could feel like stressed or petty or and actually saying, oh my God, I'm feeling this, why am I feeling this, right? And so recognizing that, because a lot of times we talk about learning for failure or mistakes, or, you know, we're on and on about it, but I actually think it's actually being able to recognize, being aware, just being aware.
Okay. Is there anything, do you have a funny story for us? I mean, you have traveled the world and been in a lot of situations.
So I'm going to tell you one of my favorite stories, because this has nothing to do with sports. This is growing up in my family. When my parents took us to Europe, when I was, so my family is like my sister. So we're all 2 years apart. So I was 13. My twin brother and I were 13, then 15, then 17, right? And my sister was super fashionable and super. And so she's wearing like these high heels and we're walking everywhere. And so at the end of the night, every single night, my parents would be like, don't put those shoes on. Those shoes are too, you know, too uncomfortable. By 7 p.m, my sister couldn't walk anymore and I had tennis shoes. And that was like the only time that our shoe size was the same because my foot is like bigger than hers. And so we would change shoes. So she would end up in my tennis shoes and I was in her high heels. And I would, I mean, like I was, like I said, tripping every 3 steps, right? And so I'm like, so I tripped with tennis shoes. So now imagine me in high heels. So my poor brother, my older brother, he has like this amazing imagination and he is in his own world because this is who he is. And he, this is who he was at the time as well. And so he was on his, in his own world kind of, and I trip and fall and my brother laughs and my mom just, why do you laugh at your sister? You know, she's helping your other sister. And why would you do? And my brother has absolutely no idea. He didn't even see me fall. And he's like, what are you talking about, right? And then he's like, I am here thinking that I'm walking by and I'm like thinking that I'm going to spit my gum. And then this policeman comes over and says, you can't do that. And he goes, yes, I can. And he spits his, this was like what he was thinking in his mind. He's telling us. So the fact that he was able to tell us the story that he was thinking of and how things, how you should really, it's a very funny story of my family, but it's also kind of like a lesson in don't assume things. Like my mom assumed that he was making fun of me and he wasn't. He was in his own world.
Okay, changing gears. What does hope mean to you?
I don't know, because I don't want to connect it necessarily with faith, you know, because I don't, you know, I'm not, it's almost like knowing that it's going to be okay. Like just trusting that it's going to be okay. And that if it's not okay, it's not the end. So it's almost like I actually believe in humankind. And I actually believe that when people make mistakes, you have a chance to learn and grow. And so that's hope for me.
What is your biggest takeaway from the great pause that COVID has created?
Having more meaningful conversations, I think, like actually people being able to connect a little bit more. And I hope that that doesn't go away once we start getting, you know, like once we, and the fact that there is no normal.
Yeah.
Because people keep talking about, oh, the new normal. I mean, it's like, what is normal? Like, I mean, like as humans, we've gone through so many things, you know, as a human race and as a human, and you hear about the first time that this happened in 1918 and how you know, and we recovered as humans, you know, we recovered. And so, and then how little do we learn at times and how we have the opportunity to learn so much more.
Who is the bravest leader you know? Why is that? And what elements of humanness do they display and allow others to display?
So I've been fortunate enough to have coaches and some managers that were great leaders. But like for me, my dad was a great leader. He was a cardiovascular surgeon. And I remember my dad explaining, I had a friend whose daughter needed to have a surgery, heart surgery, and her daughter was 4 years old. And I remember my friend being incredibly afraid, and my dad wasn't going to perform the surgery, but connected them and so that my dad could explain what was happening, right? And so my dad had a little 4-year-old on his lap and he drew a heart, but he drew a Valentine heart, not like a heart, you know, like a, he drew a Valentine heart and explained how her valve wasn't closing, like how there was a little door that needed, and the way that he explained it to this 4-year-old, that the 4-year-old was like smiling and looking at the picture and getting it. And then seeing my friend crying because it's the first time that she understood what her daughter had to go through. And so for me, that being able to connect at whatever level you can, like having that ability. And then other leaders that I've seen that make space for people who know more. So if you know more, then you step up and being able to give other people room.
What is an example of the best in humanity that you have seen during this time?
Teachers, doctors, nurses, the people who come to pick up your garbage, the people that, you know, just the people who keep delivering things, the people out in restaurants who keep trying to make it work for their employees and for their, you know, like just, and just people coming out to help. People making sure that other people have an opportunity, that other people, you know, just these stories of teachers that of kids that are not getting it, and the teacher pulls up and drives and has like a, you know, a board and starts teaching to through a window to a kid, or just those connections and that care and that passion, because that for me, that's like that passion that you have of actually helping someone else.
Yeah.
Those are for me the biggest takeaways. And I would rather focus on those than on some of the other that are not great.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Who are two or three people who have influenced you and how did they impact your life?
I don't like it when I'm limited to two or three people because I can think of so many people that have. But I mean, for me, like my family is front and center for me, starting with my parents and siblings and my kids. I mean, my kids are the biggest influence in my life. I mean, they're my driving force. And then Gloria Balaguer is a huge influence on my life. She has been a rock for me. She is one of my best, you know, yeah, she's someone that I go to and I can, I mean, I've had a couple of conversations when I can, Gloria is a person that I can call and I say, since this is only happening to me, let me tell you my problem, you know, like during COVID, right? Where everything is, and you're talking about something maybe petty or dumb, or but it's happening to you at the moment. And so I would call her and say, since this is only happening to me, I need to tell you. And she has been a rock for me always.
And tell us your connection with her.
She and I have known each other since 93 or something like that. Yeah, we met a long time ago as performance psychologists. So yeah. She went to Mar del Plata as well. So we've known each other for a very, very long time. And we just connected at a different level. And she's just a wonderful, wonderful human being.
Well, Christina, we think you're a wonderful human being. Just incredible. The experiences you've had along the way. And we thank you for that. I know there's many more stories you could tell, but thank you for leaving us with what you have. We really appreciate it. And I really believe it's made a difference. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Christina Fink, performance psychologist. So conscious of creating a safe space for the athletes she works with. And if you think of impact, Christina herself said, "You never know who you're going to impact, and you never know what you're leaving behind." Well, I think you've impacted all of us who have listened, so thank you. If you'd like to hear another story from another hero in our midst, then check out our website, heroesinourmidst.ca. Follow us, like us, subscribe to our podcast. There are so many stories to tell, and we are taking the time. Thanks for listening.